Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. When Chelsea Clinton, a Methodist, married Mark Mezvinsky, a conservative Jew, last week, they joined a rapidly growing category among U.S. couples, the mixed or interfaith marriage. 20 years ago, that group represented about one-fourth of the married couples in the United States. In 2008, that number had grown to 37%, according to the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life. So you have to wonder, does it still matter? And it must, because there was an awful lot written about it last week, and that's what we're going to talk about today. We've invited a variety of religious leaders to talk about the issue. Coming up later, we'll talk with a Catholic priest, a Jewish rabbi, and a Muslim imam. Joining us now, the Reverend Leslie Taylor. She is the Director of Student Services and the United Church of Christ Minister in Residence at Methodist Theological School in Delaware, right?
Yes.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. You are fully supportive of interfaith marriages.
Absolutely.
But still, does it make, just because you support it, does it make it easy? So tell us, does it make any difference when someone does marry someone?
I think it does, in this sense, that as long as people are respectful of each other's faith tradition, then I think it's fine, and I think it can work. I think we get into danger when one spouse tries to convert the other spouse, unless that's part of the agreement when they go in. But I think that the world is changing so significantly, and it wasn't all that long ago that it was illegal, for example, for an interracial couple to be married. And now it's, you know, now you look around and there's so many people celebrating that variety of human experience. And I think religion is the same way, that when we respect one another's traditions, when we respect one another's faiths, it strengthens. It doesn't diminish, I don't believe. I think it strengthens not only the religious dialogue, but I think it strengthens indeed the community.
What do you mean by faith traditions?
Whether or not, for example, if you're Muslim or and Christian or Jewish and Christian or of another faith. And there are, you know, as we talked about just before the program, there are ecumenical marriages, intrafaith.
Two Christians, different.
Exactly.
Yeah,
two Christians, different faith traditions, right. Or different denominations. But when I'm speaking in terms of interfaith, I'm talking about, you know, the premise, the body of what it is they believe, who they worship, how they worship, those kinds of things.
Does it matter if either or both people in the marriage are very religious or not very religious at all? In other words, someone who says they're Catholic, but, oh, I'm a bad Catholic, you know, that kind of thing, or I'm a fallen Catholic or whatever, but they still have traditions.
They absolutely do. They absolutely do. I think the way in which we live out what we were raised with, those traditions, you know, what do you do in December? You know, do you celebrate Hanukkah? Do you celebrate Christmas? Do you celebrate Kwanzaa, which isn't a religious holiday, but it is a cultural holiday? You know, have you just finished with Ramadan? You know, that kind of thing. I mean, mm-hmm. what are the traditions in your household? Because when we think back to childhood, assuming that we've had a positive experience in our childhood, when we think back to childhood, those are those fond memories. And how do those get lived out in a new marriage? When I was serving as a pastor, and I would counsel folks on before they got married, we talked about we had five F's: faith, family, fighting, and finances.
Isn't fighting caused by finances?
Sometimes, and sometimes it's caused by faith.
Right.
So, and then the last F was whatever they wanted to make up, and generally it was fun. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how do you still have fun? But the important thing is that when we live our lives, whether or not we go to church or whatever the religious institution is, whether or not we worship every week, whether or not we have there is still in us a set of core values, a set of expectations about the way the world works. And generally, those are formed by and informed by our faith, even if it's a nominal faith in terms of the way someone lives it out.
And you're talking about how we intellectualize it. It's, I think, maybe sometimes after you get married and you're faced with some of these complexities,
precisely,
that's when you realize the emotional depths.
Exactly. Exactly. That is exactly it. Because on the one hand, we may say, oh, it doesn't really matter. God is God. And, you know, and we all serve God. We all, you know, love God, whatever. We all worship God in this kind of intellectual, heady kind of way. Mm-hmm. But as soon from a Christian perspective, as soon as Easter rolls around or Holy Week rolls around or Christmas rolls around, I know I've got some emotional connection to that. And what does that mean if I don't have the opportunity to live that out?
Or don't feel comfortable living it out
in the context of my marriage or my relationship.
We are talking about interfaith marriages today. My guest right now, the Reverend Leslie Taylor of the United Church of Christ, minister in residence at the Ohio
Methodist Theological School in Ohio.
Thank you. Methodist Theological School in Ohio. Questions, comments, 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And I asked for questions on the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page, too, if you want to wander over there. When you marry people of different faiths, at the outset, are they convinced that all love will conquer all?
Or are
they usually cognizant of the potential for conflict down the road?
I think it depends on how old they are.
Okay.
If they're
like
young.
So many other things. Right?
Exactly. If they're young, love will conquer all.
Mm-hmm.
And through the course of – I generally – when I marry a couple, I generally work with them for about a year before I marry them. And that doesn't matter who they are.
Is it something you require?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Wow.
if we're going to spend that much time planning the wedding,
sure,
and spending all that money on the wedding, let's hope the marriage lasts, you know. And so we do. We spend a significant amount of time working and working through those issues.
Like real regular counseling sessions,
yes,
with groups and,
yes,
different kinds of things. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And I generally meet with, you know, like as I said, I generally meet with the couple over the course of a year. And so, as I was saying, that if they're really young, love will conquer all.
Mm-hmm.
And then they start to realize over the course of the year, oh, there are some things that are really important to us that we need to talk about. Particularly when it comes to family and when it comes to, what is your family of origin and what are those traditions? But also, what is the family you're going to create? You know, how are the two of you going to be family? And then if you have children, what happens then? And that's when people start to think.
We have a question now from a caller. Zaina, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. Actually, it's an observation.
Okay.
Interfaith marriages are successful until children arrive. And then my observation has been that each one of the couples will try and pull the child in a different direction. And I've seen more than one interfaith marriage fail due to that.
Do you think, Zaina, that's because they didn't think about it first? They waited
until... I think they thought this is something they could overcome. And then, when the child is more aware of the concept of religion, it's like, you know, do I take him to church? Do I take him to a mosque?
Mm-hmm.
And that has been,
Reverend Taylor, does that have to be that way? I mean,
no.
The conflict you just acknowledged, when children come along, there,
yeah,
can create some conflict.
Yes, there can. There can. But on a personal note, my best friend from seminary came back to our dorm one day and said, I just met the man I'm going to marry. And this was about 25 years ago. And she said, but there's a problem. Now, mind you, she's in seminary. She's studying to be a pastor. Okay.
The real deal.
The real deal. And so she comes home and she says, there's two problems. One is he's Jewish and my father will blow a gasket, and because her father was also a pastor. And the second is that he was an actor and a singer. And I said, well, your father's going to blow a gasket more over that, I think, than the first. But and they've been married for 20 some years. They've got three wonderful children. I celebrated holidays with them from the time the children were babies. And they did both Christmas and Hanukkah. They did Passover and Holy Week and Easter.
Was it something that they
talked about
before they married?
Absolutely. Yeah, they talked about it before they married. And they talked about it continually as the children were getting – as the children came along and as the children got older.
I wonder if what Zaina's asking about are folks who maybe – Zaina, and correct me if I'm wrong, but maybe folks who aren't necessarily very devout in their religions. So they don't – again, it's what we brought up earlier. It's not until you get married and have kids and all of a sudden that depth of emotion is brought out. Mm-hmm. Is that possibly what you're thinking of, Zaina? I guess Zaina's gone.
She may have hung up, but she does bring up a good point. Mm-hmm. I think that when the stress of what do you do when the children come, when we get faced with that and we realize that deep within us are those core values and how do those get lived out, that's where that tension can come. I would hope and pray that it doesn't destroy marriages. I would hope and pray that, in this case, in some ways, love does conquer all, but not in a fairy tale kind of way. That one of the things I hand to couples, particularly young couples, when we get to the fighting part of our counseling, is a respectful communication guideline. And it actually comes from Eric Law, who works with multicultural understanding and diversity kind of awareness, that kind of thing. And the respectful communication guidelines, it spells out the word respect, but it's take responsibility for what you say and feel without blaming others. Use empathetic listening. Be sensitive to differences in communication styles. Ponder what you hear and feel before you speak. Examine your own assumptions and perceptions. Keep confidentiality. Now that's, you know, in essence, I'm not going to run out now. Of course, everybody's going to hear what we're saying. I don't mean it in that sense. But if you and I were having a private conversation, then I'm not going to run out and say, well, Imam Tarat said that, you know.
Are these guidelines that you give to any?
I give them to everybody.
To be married couple? Yep.
But particularly when the couple is of two different faith traditions.
Okay.
Because when we get to that place of fighting about something or arguing, I stay F because it's just easier for me to keep them. but when we get to that place of arguing, we argue about the things that we feel threatened by. And if we feel threatened, if our sense of security, or at least a part of our sense of security, rests in our understanding of the divine in our lives, and I feel like you're taking that away from me, or you're telling me that my understanding of the divine is not as valid as your understanding of the divine, that's threatening. And so, of course, it's going to generate an argument, and of course, it's going to generate conflict. But it doesn't have to, I don't believe, it doesn't have to be so destructive that it destroys a relationship.
We have to take a break now. You've been listening to the Reverend Leslie Taylor, and coming up, Father Rob Runke and also Imam Muhammad Tarazi. We'll be right back on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Washington's weather finally cooled off, but the heat is on. Two Democrats facing ethics charges. Maxine Waters says, go ahead, put me on trial. Meg Whitman spends gobs of her own cash in California, and it's another big primary day in the Midwest. I'm Tony Cox. Ken Rutan joins us, an ethically challenged edition of The Political Junkie. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation begins this afternoon at 2 o'clock right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher today. And All Sides will be broadcasting live from the Columbus Public Health's Farmers Market tomorrow from 10 until noon. Join us on the front lawn of the Health Department building at 240 Parsons Avenue. Hear about the importance of farmers markets to increase access to fresh fruits and vegetables for urban residents. That's tomorrow at 10 a.m. on Parsons Avenue. Join us for All Sides with Ann Fisher. And it's 79 degrees in downtown Columbus, cloudy skies with a chance of rain today and a high of 88. All Sides continues on WOSU 820, NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's funny what big fancy weddings of famous people will inspire. I don't remember the last time someone mentioned the religious background of a movie star that got married. But when Chelsea Clinton married last weekend, she married conservative Jew Mark Mezvinsky. And everybody was talking about it because, of course, Chelsea is well known as a Methodist. So we're talking about that, interfaith marriages, intrafaith marriages for that matter. And joining us now is Father Rob Runke. He was ordained a Catholic priest in 1966 and is the author of For Better and Forever, the most widely used marriage preparation program using mentor couples to assist engaged couples. He is the director of Marriage Preparation Resources. You can learn more about that at marriagepreparation.com, and we'll post it on our website at wosu.org/allsides. If you want to go to our website, we can get that that link for you. Welcome to the show, Father Rob.
Good morning.
Also with us today, Columbus Imam Muhammad Tarazi. He is also president of the Islamic Society of Greater Columbus. He has married some 300 couples now, something like that,
yes,
including interfaith couples.
Yes.
Yes. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Father Rob, the Catholic Church didn't used to permit interfaith marriages, right?
Yeah, that was correct. We, up until about 1964, there was pretty much a policy of discouraging that at all costs. And only if a person was willing to sign a document that they were willing to raise the children Catholic would the church allow the Catholic to marry the person. But that changed after 1964. And if it would be helpful, I could just go over some of the things that are now possible that a lot of people may not know about.
Sure.
Would that be helpful?
Sure. Well, yeah.
So the policy is that the Catholic Church now affirms the conscience and beliefs of each person in the couple and does not attempt to force anyone to become Catholic when he or she plans to marry a Catholic. Second point is the Catholic Church affirms the right and the responsibility of the Catholic parent to pass on his or her faith to the children, but the Church also affirms the same rights and responsibilities for the person who's not Catholic. So that is what a lot of people don't know very much about.
Since they changed the rules, has the number of Catholics marrying outside their faith skyrocketed?
Well, I don't know that the rule change caused that to happen. Mm-hmm. I think that's just been happening, and
okay,
I'm happy that the rules are kind of making it easier for couples to deal with that reality.
We were talking about premarital counseling. Reverend Taylor said that she typically wants to, over the course of a year, meet with a couple several times. How about you? What do you recommend? I know that the Catholic Church has the pre-Cana requirement. It can be anything from a one-day seminar to sometimes a week-long, sometimes longer, I suppose. What do you look for, typically?
Well, I've been doing this kind of ministry since the end of the 60s. I've been doing it a long time. And when I started out years ago, I was doing the kind of the typical thing of getting people together in groups and getting myself and other couples to give them talks and all that sort of thing. But about the middle of the 70s, it dawned on me that we needed to do it differently. So So there was a priest in San Antonio who was training married people to meet one-on-one with engaged couples. He called them sponsor couples, or sometimes it's called mentor couples.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the best way to do it. In my program, for example, that's exactly what I do, is the program is set up to then recruit and train married couples to work one-on-one with the engaged. Why I think that's so important, and particularly for interfaith, interchurch couples, is that they hear from a married couple who can talk much more realistically about marriage, and that's the advantage of them meeting a number of times over a number of weeks, because usually when people are getting married, they're thinking much more about the wedding ceremony and how the wedding is going to make everything better. And spending a number of weeks with a married couple and their children sometimes can really bring a dose of reality into that.
Because we're in denial when it's our own family. It's like, well, nobody else's family's like mine.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
Imam Tarazi, what are the rules in the Muslim faith as far as marriage goes, interfaith marriage?
First of all, I think I need just to add a little bit into the
sure.
discussion here is that we need to understand that marriages in general come with challenges. And most people don't know that when they go into marriages. Now, these challenges are increased when it's interfaith marriages. And it's even more increased when interculture marriages are concerned. And I do perform marriages from different religions and different cultures. And I always tell them that you are going to be facing a bit more challenges than if you're marrying from the same culture and from the same faith. As far as your question is, I do perform many, many marriages where Muslim men do marry a Christian woman in Columbus, Ohio here. Mm-hmm. And again, I stress that, you know, this is permissible, but again, it comes with additional challenges that needs to be looked into. People go into marriages with expectations, and when they see these expectations are not realized, they find out that there's a problem. And the proof of this is the rate of divorce. When you're talking about 50% almost divorce in general, and this about 75% rate of divorce in the interfaith marriages, so you see the problem. Now, as the Reverend said, when they are young and not so much religious, things may seem to be really good and so on and so forth, they're happy. But then soon after that, when they're hit with some sort of a calamity, the boy or the girl loses their mom or their dad, then they go back to religion. Mm-hmm. And then some of them gets too close to being very religious. Then how is that going to be seen by the other partner, and how are they going to be able to work that out or not? And I really commend Reverend Leslie for her one-year program. I think we need to prepare this couple to tell them these are the realities, not the realities. These are not just a wedding dress, and that's why they call it honeymoon, because after a month, it's done. Okay, now what? And that comes financial responsibilities, raising children. Again, raising children become a problem afterward because they don't think about it. Then if every partner wants to raise the children differently in terms of religion or, mm-hmm. or practices. So there are some challenges that come with it, no doubt about it.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Anthony, you're on the air. You're bringing up another question. You're agnostic, and you're soon to marry a devout Christian.
Yeah, and actually it's very topical to me because what the imam just said, she's actually of Egyptian descent, or she was born in Egypt and came over here, so there have been some cultural challenges as well. But I was just curious what the take is on someone who doesn't have a specific faith or might be a soft atheist coming into a religious marriage. And at least in my case, it seemed like the burden of expectation was on me to kind of, you know, bend my will to satisfy the religious person and family in the relationship.
In other words, embrace a religion.
Yeah, I've been baptized in 3 different religions now. I always joke that I'm starting a punch card, and the first
one
will be free.
You're easy to get along with. That's one.
Well, I mean, when you don't hold a very strong opinion of religion yourself, it's kind of tough to let yourself get wrapped up in it just because it doesn't really mean anything to me.
So, is that, well,
Why would you get baptized then? I'm just curious.
Because it's, well, honestly, I've seen the girl for about 10 years. We started dating in high school. And when her parents found out that I did not believe in God, they actually forbid us to see each other anymore. And because of her cultural background, she's very close with her family. She only came over to the States when she was 10 or 11. And so I wasn't about to stand in the way of that relationship, and mm-hmm. it seemed like participating in her faith was the easiest way for me to facilitate the relationship moving forward because I love and care about her.
How about some recommendations? Father Rob, any recommendations to them about how to prepare for this marriage?
Well, again, I go back to the idea of using a very good marriage preparation program. There are others that are good as well as mine, but also meeting with a sponsor mentor couple, I think, is it just has proved excellent through the years, because if people do that, there's more likelihood that that sponsor or mentor couple can continue in that relationship beyond the wedding ceremony into the first years of marriage. And when that happens, I see pretty amazing kinds of things happen if they keep in touch, because once people marry and then they begin to have the real issues of marriage, then who do they talk to? And if you talk to your best friend or your family, those people are all programmed to take sides. Why mm-hmm. wouldn't they? Mm-hmm. So it's important to have some kind of relationship with someone like the sponsor or mentor couple who's trained to not take sides and to be in favor of the couple, and to now help them deal with what they had talked about earlier, but now it becomes real, and now you have to begin to deal with things. I just think that in general, not only interfaith, interchurch marriages, but I think all marriages would do much better if people could think of marriage as at least as important as your career, mm-hmm. and in your career, you're doing constant competing with other people to do better, to learn more and all that sort of thing. But we tend, in at least in North America and probably most countries, that once you get married, then you just put the marriage on automatic pilot and get back to the business of life, which doesn't work very well, and that's why the divorce rate is so high. So I think that if more people could see marriage as something to continually work at and find people who agree with that, we'll all do better.
Certainly, and we had that offer made to us. Her priest found a couple that he suggested we spend some time with and kind of learn from. And while it was useful on some fronts, I found that overall they're still coming from a Christian faith. And so from my perspective, the sides have already been taken on that matter, I guess, because they have faith.
So maybe find, Father Rob, maybe find a sponsor couple that mirrors the same kind of a demographic?
Well, at least a couple that's aware of the differences between them, and is hopefully the agenda of a sponsor couple isn't to preach religion. It's to help the couple wherever mm-hmm. they are, and if they're two different places, that's part of what they would be hopefully teaching the engaged couple to deal with. It's the fact that if one is atheist and one is Christian, and they intend to marry, how are they going to learn to give equal respect to the other side of that? And that's part of the project of marriage preparation,
Imam,
hopefully.
Imam Tarazi, what about in the Muslim faith? Is it when you're talking about an interfaith, well, a one-faith marriage, one person has a faith and the other person doesn't at all?
But wouldn't that be the words may be funny, but even a non-faith is some kind of faith statement. Mm-hmm.
It's a commitment in a direction.
Yeah.
But is it...
Muslims are only allowed to marry from people of the book, meaning Jews and Christians. If a girl does not believe in God at all, a Muslim man does not have the permission to marry that girl.
Which brings up another question. Girls are not permitted at all to marry outside of the faith in the Muslim tradition.
That is true.
Has that created any kind of problems? I'm sure it has. Any kind of rules creates rule breakers. But have you noticed anything over the years of more girls?
I haven't really noticed. There might have been very, very isolated cases where the girl met a Christian boy and insisted on marrying him. Excuse me. But it's really, really rare cases. In general, it's not allowed. It's not allowed for a Muslim girl, to marry non-Muslim, and there is a lot of reasons for that. Again, it comes to practicing. We fast for a whole month. Now, if she's fasting, what is her husband going to do during that month?
So just practical traditions.
It's a lot of issues that comes. And then a Muslim woman, when she gets into the marriage, she gets to with the understanding that her husband is responsible for her, for the family, for the finances, and whatever she makes is her money. Now, when she gets married with somebody from a different religion and different culture, that person might say, wait a minute, no, this is a 50-50% kind of 50-50 kind of relationship. So different expectations, different kind of, and again, comes down to how to raise the children.
Mm-hmm. We have to take another break. I want to say thanks to Anthony for his call. We appreciated the conversation. We have some more calls coming up. We'll get to those. Emails, too. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and do it there. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Get a fresh perspective on the news with Capital City Radio, an HD radio service from WOSU. Start your day with The Takeaway and be a part of the American conversation. Or get a global perspective with PRI's The World. Enjoy a blend of old and new music with insightful news and talk programs. Listen to Capital City Radio on HD3 89.7 FM or online at capitalcityradio.org. And you're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides will be here and calling all language lovers. We'll hear about grammar usage and word usage and some tips to become a more effective writer with Grammar Girl. That discussion is at 11, right here on WOSU 820.
Support for WOSU comes from the law firm Isaac Brandt Ledman and Teeter, offering legal services to Central Ohio since 1936. Isaac Brandt Ledman and Teeter, big enough to win, small enough to care, on the web at isaacbrandt.com.
All Sides will be broadcasting live from the Columbus Public Health Farmers Market tomorrow from 10 until noon. Join us on the front lawn of the Health Department building at 240 Parsons Avenue. Hear about the importance of farmers markets to increase access to fresh fruits and vegetables for urban residents. That's tomorrow beginning at 10 on Parsons Avenue. Join us for All Sides with Ann Fisher. And it's 79 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:40. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about interfaith marriages today, inspired by the wedding over the past weekend of Chelsea Clinton, a Methodist, and Mark Mezvinsky, a conservative Jew. Joining us now in the conversation is Columbus Jewish Federation's Jewish Education and Identity Vice President, Rabbi Edith Jacques. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. According to the New York Times, a story this week, the last major population study of the nation's Jews in 2001 found that since 1996, 47% of the marriages involving a Jew were interfaith. And before 1970, the rate was 13%. What do you see as the greatest factors in that trend, Rabbi?
I think that in general, and someone mentioned this earlier, is that I think America has become a very multicultural nation. And I think a lot of the boundaries that used to be the case for mixing between cultures, religions, and races have been the boundaries are not there anymore. The stigma is no longer there. So I recognize that while the Jewish numbers are definitely, they're very easy to see, and in a large part because in the former part of the last century, Jews lived a lot more of a segregated life. And I think, as in many of the different populations, when there's much more diversity, then the marriage, intermarriage rates will increase.
You know, in that same article in the New York Times, a Chicago lawyer was interviewed about his own interfaith marriage 30 years ago, and I thought he brought up an interesting point. He said that they shouldn't look at it as a loss, he added, referring to statements made in the past week by Jewish organizations and their leaders. He said, although there is a risk, there is that risk, there's also the possibility of gain, which it has been for us. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. I think I recognize in part that what he's saying is, I shouldn't say him, but when
it
one
was
says
him.
That,
you're right.
Yeah, it was him, but can't speak to his life, but a lot of times because, you know, for an individual, they still have an identity as a Jew or a Christian or a Muslim or whatever it may be. They haven't lost their identity. So I think sometimes when it's viewed as a loss, it seems to diminish their own value. However, I do think that there is not necessarily a recognition that when someone is going to get married, people tend to get married and have children. And what are the effects that that has on future generations? And in addition, there are, you know, a lot of different mixed studies out there in terms of the ramifications of whether or not interfaith marriages are the actual wedding ceremony are presided over by religious leaders. And for a lot of people, they think that that will make a difference in terms of raising their children a certain way or not. But some studies have actually shown it doesn't make a difference. I think the other concern about that is to say that it could be a gain. It's been touched on earlier. I don't think many people, as we've said, should go into a marriage hoping to eventually convert their spouse to something. So a potential gain going into a marriage means that there's an assumption there that perhaps then whoever is speaking on their behalf thinks that the other person may convert to their religion. I'm not sure that the healthiest approach of going into a marriage is a potential gain, because we may convert people. I think that marriage is much more substantial to look at it as the hope of adding another one to your tradition. I think that can set up for disappointment.
What about the gain of enrichment, that maybe not conversion, but you have a richer life, you have a more to your life?
I do think that there is a gain of knowledge and awareness. I think that people have to ask the question, though, do I want to gain knowledge and enrichment through the intimacy of my marriage? This is my life partner, my lover, the parent of my children. Is that where I want to have my boundaries stretched? There are so many other things. Marriages are so complex. We learn just the amount of patience and exposure to another human being on such a regular, intimate basis is bound to push people and expand their horizons. I think depending on your own identity when you go into a marriage, are those the type of things where you want to learn and understand, or are you willing to be changed? I think it's a very fundamental question about someone's identity and who they are and how formed they are. I know a lot of the people earlier spoke about when you're younger. I think you're much more open to influence and change of your identities, but if you have a strong religious identity of who you are, it affects not just your intellect and your emotions, but also your behavior and your choices you make. Do you
how strongly do you feel about those choices, that there are things that you want to challenge?
614-292-8513. And Mark, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Ann. I've got some questions that any of your guests could comment on, and I'll be real quick on this. If in a mixed religious marriage, if the couple comes in with outright antagonism towards each other's religion, that does not bode well for the marriage.
Doesn't bode well for any marriage, I would posit. So go ahead. I'm sorry, Mark.
what tends to happen more often is there's sort of a reluctant toleration. I guess the ideal situation in a mixed marriage is there'd be mutual respect and support for each other's faith or rights or practices. I wondered if they had any thoughts on that. And there's one other real practical question. Many people are basically maybe so dysfunctional, they're incapable of either fulfilling the covenantal relationships of a religious marriage or maybe the more legal aspects of the secular marriage contract. So they're not well prepared for either, but they do have a natural desire for intimacy and family formation. And also I wondered if any of the guests had any thoughts on the practicalities of people that probably will not be able to do the marriage properly, but they still want to be together with someone, and what should those folks do? And I'll take it off the air. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Mark. Rabbi, you want to take a swing at that?
Sure. I think that he raises a really good point about the difference between a reluctant tolerance and support and respect. Mm-hmm. I think that to have tolerance of, or as you asked kind of earlier, okay, so we'll have a Christmas tree and we'll celebrate this. I think that there's a difference between that, between being open and saying, okay, I'll learn about this. But I think also what he's getting to is kind of also the fundamental difference in that, you know, I can believe that it's good for me to be open and learn about these. It's another, though, to say that I'm willing to bring that into my life and my own beliefs. And when he mentioned the fulfilling covenantal obligations, I also think that that's very powerful. And he mentioned, how does that compare to a desire for intimacy? I think that, for example, a lot of conversations happen to be about what would we do for our children. One of my own rabbis said to me, Rabbi Mark Lichtman said to me 15 years ago, when I started having these conversations with him and learning about this, don't ever talk about the children. Talk about what's important to you. And I think that was a very significant message, and that it very much goes to the point of the caller's questions, in the sense that you only want with your children that which is important to you. So a reluctant tolerance is, you know, you might be able to tolerate some things, but the reason the kids mark things up is just because it's really, what are you willing to believe in yourself? And if you have a feeling that a marriage is about fulfilling covenantal obligations, that's very different than just wanting to have harmony in your home. You have a sense of obligation. But it's very hard when we do have this desire to have intimacy with another person. And I think that's very much, it makes sense to me why his last question was kind of some practical advice, because to have respect for another person's belief and to have some understanding is one thing, but to live that out about what does that mean about what we're going to do, and I think that's where children come in. So I believe this. How does that mean I'm going to live my life, and how does that influence the choices that I'm going to make? And I think it takes a lot of understanding for people to respect those differences and recognize how they influence each other.
How often do you see folks getting into marriages when they're, and this usually is when they're young, we talked about it earlier, that mm-hmm. they're not very committed to their faith, whatever it is, and through marriage and through, you know, the covenant of marriage and then having children, and then you're faced with the different rites of passage for your children. You have death. All these different rites of passage seem to bring out different depths.
Yes, and I think because when your child goes through a life cycle event, I agree that it brings out some philosophical thoughts and emotional thoughts, but also touches on your question of kind of the meaning of your life and what is the significance about these things? So it's very natural that life cycle events, and I think that that in part is what that faith is, it's, or religion is. I would say it's a little bit more than just worship and prayer. Mm-hmm. It's our response to what does it mean to be a human being? I think that ultimately is what a religion answers. So when you see the point of having children or mourning the loss of a parent or going through a life cycle event, and it makes you question those fundamental things, and those are informed by your religion, someone from another faith has been informed potentially very differently than you have been. So you approach those events very differently. Someone else, I think, made the point earlier about the level of being devout. I think that if someone has thought about this and their opinions and their views are very well formed, you can maybe get along very harmoniously with someone else who doesn't have a strong opinion in the sense that this is my child, I love them, I want this to be a good and meaningful experience for them. And if the rest is details, you'll get along. But where you fit on that spectrum will make a big difference about how you're going to communicate with your spouse.
And
go ahead, Reverend Taylor.
And I think that I think that the rabbi makes a very good point, because indeed, you know, our understanding of faith, I think, does speak to the question of what does it mean to be human, and what does it mean, you know, the old joke, what's the meaning of life? Well, these questions answer that question, I think. But one of the things that, at the risk of tooting my school's horn, at the risk of doing that, one of the things that we that I think a lot of seminaries offer now, but I know that ours does a particularly good job of, is working with is helping our folk who are moving through the track toward ordination in understanding cross-cultural relationships as well as interfaith relationships. And we have a professor who's on sabbatical this semester, or this year, I should say, Dr. Paul Numerick, who is the professor of world religions and interreligious relations for our school, but also for the Theological Consortium of Greater Columbus. And I think one of the key things, and taking a class in world religions is a requirement for our students. And I think that that helps when couples get to those moments of stress in their lives, those life moments, those life-changing moments, having a religious leader, pastor, I mean, whatever the title would be, mm-hmm. But having a religious leader that understands on some level what each of those faith traditions is saying, I think helps that couple move through that particular challenge in their lives together. And I think that I can't speak for other religious training institutions, but from a Christian perspective, I think that if all of our seminaries did what Methodist Theological School does, in the sense of requiring our students to have a class in world religions and have a class and take a cross-cultural experience, that helps to broaden one's perspective. And then that gets carried out into whatever your ministry is, whether it's in a local religious setting or if it's a wider kind of experience.
Ivan Tarazi?
excuse me. Well, I think the issue of tolerance, support, and respect and sacrifice, these are important in every marriage. Mm-hmm. And people seem not to really be understanding these kind of things, especially the issue of sacrifice, because in any marriage, people need to sacrifice. The issue is here, when a Muslim man wants to get married with a Christian, he, as a precondition, he needs to understand and agree that beforehand, not after the fact, that she's free to practice her religion as she chooses. And I tell those people, don't hope. You can hope if you want in your mind, but don't make it in your mind, I'm going to convert her, because that might not happen. So you need to, if it happens, if that pleases you, good. But if it doesn't happen, don't make that destroy your marriage. Make it hard on your marriage. So people before, in addition to what the Reverend is saying, is when we're preparing this, this is the person you're marrying today. You know, I see somebody says she's short, but you married her short.
I was going to raise that earlier, and I will now. Any kind of reluctance, anything you hold against somebody when you marry, and no one's perfect, it always seems to be the thing you pull out of your bag of tricks when you're having a fight. So if it's religion, or if it's your mother bugs me, or your, you know, blah, blah, blah. I mean, that could be the truth. And religion, though, is a little bit more incendiary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Could I add, this is Father Runke again.
Father Rob, yeah.
Could I want to add a little bit here about the importance of couples studying their family of origin and how this very much affects faith. What I believe at this point and tell other people is that if you're Catholic or Methodist or atheist or whatever you happen to be, because you came out of this family or whatever, but have you really studied what that religion is? Because what I think is true is that if you inherit the faith of your family, it's the faith of your family, but it may not necessarily coincide with the official teachings of that religion. And I think everyone needs to look at that very carefully, because oftentimes two people can be both Catholic, but they have such different ideas of the Catholic faith that they're absolutely incompatible as a couple because of what they think they believe.
Father Rob?
Yes?
We have to cut it off there.
Okay.
That was a great point. Thank you for making it. Thank you for joining us today, Father Rob Runke. Appreciate it. Also, Reverend Leslie Taylor, thanks for joining us today. Imam Tarazi, appreciate your being here with us.
Thank you.
And Rabbi Jacques, thank you so much for being with us.
Sure thing.
That's all the time we have for this episode of All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.